I'd like your copy of the transcript from you. Will you put it in transcript form?
Yes, sir. Certainly will.
Am I talking loud enough for that prayer?
I believe so. It works pretty well. First question, I read in your book, My Father, My Son, you did not consider South Vietnam to be, quote, a viable national entity capable of repelling Hanoi's aggression, and that American involvement in the conflict in Southeast Asia would, quote, impose a substantial drain on our military strength, unquote. Now, naturally, when you go there, you'll have a different perspective. And what, if anything, changed your mind and made you become dedicated to the success of the program?
Well, once the decision was made by the president that we were going to be there, then my duty was to make it work and to be as optimistic as I could. And indeed, I still think, as I indicated today, that although it was the wrong place to be taking a stand because of the history of colonialism and so forth, and because it wasn't a viable national entity, that we'd have been better off to build up the rest of Southeast Asia and not have had to get a horrible number of troops involved. Nevertheless, in spite of all that, in spite of the fact that I felt it was the wrong decision, I still thought there was a chance to bring it off as things had developed. And to this day, I believe that we had it won, minus Watergate. That we would have had a two Vietnam solution, that any time they violated the truce, we'd have hammered them, just as we've kept troops in South Korea for half a century. We might have had to keep them there for 20 or 25 or 30 years. But the nation over time, with a lot of bitching on the side, would have supported that, and we could have had a South Vietnam that was as prosperous as South Korea has become, leaving the North progressively in the dust.
Do you think that would have necessitated any incursions into other parts of Southeast Asia in order to strengthen the perimeter around South Vietnam?
I believe that we had proved that the Cambodian part of it could be isolated by the combination of boat power and infantry power. And I believe that the Vietnamese could have sustained that part of it itself. We might have had to do incursions in the I Corps and II Corps from time to time to push their base camps back and that sort of thing. But the populated areas, in my judgment, could have been pacified and protected and become increasingly pro-GVN rather than pro-NVN.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've read in both On Watch and in My Father, My Son that your first impressions upon your arrival in Saigon were very negative and revolved primarily around the perception that there was, at least in terms of the Navy, an absence of a sense of mission and the feeling among naval personnel that the war was the Army's job.
Yeah. Now here, I'll be frank, but I'd like not to go beyond really what the book said about that. Mm-hmm. I think I said in the book that we had a fairly low caliber of senior staff officers. That was not true of the youngsters in the field, because they were largely volunteers and the more adventurous guys came out and were good leaders doing what they were told to do. But because the Navy did not believe that it was career enhancing to be involved in brown water operations from the very top on down, and because the then Navy chief, in my judgment, felt that that air power was what the Navy ought to be providing, that whole mood reflected itself down, and the detailers were sending commanders and captains out there who they didn't have good jobs for because they hadn't cut it, and we therefore had dead wood on the staff, including the poor, tragic chief of staff, who was a very fine man, but just, you know, couldn't get it all together. And, the admiral, and this is the part that I think is most sensitive, Admiral F. was just a loser. He was out there having a gay social time, and not particularly interested in the war himself, and his concept was his job was to keep his troops from getting shot at. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they did almost nothing. As I indicated, I think, in the book, General Abrams didn't know what should be done, but he knew that the Navy wasn't doing a damn thing down there, and he He said that as far as he was concerned, the Navy wasn't in the war. He wasn't getting the damn thing from the Navy, referring to the brown water part of it, not to the carriers, which were not under his command. Mm-hmm. And so he said, I don't know what you're going to do, but I know that what we're doing now stinks. And it was clear that I had a mission from him to get the Navy in the war, and that I had a duty to do that, because soldiers were getting killed in greater numbers because we weren't carrying out our part of the mission.
Do you think that Admiral Beth and the feeling in Saigon at the time that let's let the Army handle this, and they're more concerned with other things, do you think that is because they perceive that the institution as a whole, on up to the CNO, did not regard the Brown Water Navy as part of the team, perhaps?
Yeah, I think the fact that it was known that the CNO thought that was a bad war and a waste of Navy talent, and by virtue of looking at who were being sent out there in the senior jobs, that was the general concept.
Mm-hmm. And so they felt that because why should they, or if we're not being respected in what we're doing, what is the point of the focus?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Later on, I think you're asking a question about my promotion and whether that indicated some difference in that attitude.
Yes, sir.
And I don't know whether I said this in the book or not, but Admiral Clary, who was the vice chief of naval operations and had been my boss, told me that at one point that Admiral Moore, who was the Navy chief, was complaining to him about the fact that Zumwalt was spending weekends on the Nitsa farm, the Nitsas, for whom I had worked when he was Secretary of the Navy and I was the captain in the Navy executive assistant. When we had orders to come back to Washington, invited my wife and me and her children to use a home on their 2,000 acre farm, and we spent almost every weekend there. And in the course of each weekend, we'd have one meal with them and they'd have one meal with us. And with his knowledge and consent, he was then Deputy Secretary of Defense, and he was giving me information that the CNO wasn't getting and authorizing me to brief the CNO on it. He knew I would anyway, and he said, "You have no problem with you doing so." So almost every Monday I would be in the office of the CNO telling the executive assistant what I had learned about what McNamara was thinking, what McNamara had said to the president, and so forth. For some reason, it galled Admiral Moore that I was getting information that he wasn't getting. And so his comment to Admiral Clary one day was he'd like to get Zumwalt out of town and break that link. Mm-hmm. So he said, "What I think I'll do is send him," he said, "I'd like to send him to Vietnam, but I don't think Nitsa would ever stand still for that." And Admiral Clary said, "Well, why don't you get that job upgraded to 3 stars and then nominate Zumwalt for it? Then you'll get Nitsa." So unbeknownst to me, this was all cooking. Now, when Admiral Moore called me in to tell me he was giving those orders, what he said to me was that he wanted to make the job more important and give the Navy more visibility out there, and he said all the right things. So it was only after the fact that I learned about this politicking side of it.
That you and the scheme had been completed to maneuver you out of the way.
Right.
Okay. So, based on what you said, it seems that the Navy had not necessarily been neglected by MACV at all. MACV had just arrived at the conclusion that the attitude in the Navy is that this, what is happening in South Vietnam, is not properly their jurisdiction. They're more concerned about the air war, and so it sort of atrophied because there wasn't any imagination as to how this could properly be deployed.
That's right. Now, to be fair, I have to point out that In another sense, the Navy had completed its original mission. The swift boats operating up and down the coast had stopped the trawler traffic, which was the way that initially the supplies were getting in, and forced the building of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And the PBRs operating in the major rivers had pretty well brought to a halt traffic by the Viet Cong in the major rivers. And the assault boats, the armored vessels, that had been used to carry the 9th Infantry Brigade around the Delta to various firefights, had pretty well completed their mission because the major Viet Cong units had been broken down and there wasn't much activity for heavy lift of Army troops. What were the few places that there was still resistance, they could helicopter forces in and that sort of thing. So Admiral Veth may have looked at it as though his job was done and just had not seen these other possibilities that, that we got into. Mm-hmm. But General Abrams certainly understood that there were resources there that weren't being used. The youngsters in the field running these boats had every reason to feel like they had done their job and were continuing to do their job, and that it was just kind of dull in comparison to what was going on in other forces.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the fact that Vietnam appeared to be, at least prior to your arrival, a dumping ground for lower quality naval officers, was that simply based on the perception, at least on Admiral Moore's part, that the air war is more important, or is there something more?
Well, it was based partly on that, partly on the fact that the senior people under Admiral Moore knew that was his view, partly on the fact that good captains and commanders were saying to themselves, "Hell, why should I waste a tour in Vietnam? That doesn't do anything for my career." Mm-hmm. So the really good guys weren't trying to get there. So it was that combination of factors, and you know, I was very fortunate in the fact that both Admiral Lin Captain Tidd and Admiral Lin Chick Rao volunteered to come, unusual for front runners, and that I was then able to get the rest of the staff upgraded by being on that telephone every night at 9 o'clock, which was 9 a.m. in Washington. Demanding from the detailer, Commander Smith or Commander Jones or Captain Brown, people that I knew specifically had talent, and then calling them and saying, "Hey, you've just been volunteered, don't veto it."
Mm-hmm. I find that interesting that Army commanders, or Army officers, excuse me, sought assignments to Vietnam because it was a chance to fill a square at a combat command. Yeah. And it wasn't viewed that way in the Navy?
Yeah, you see, for the Army, that's where the action was. Fighting in the infantry is the way you get the battlefield experience. For the Navy, it wasn't that kind of a war. The Navy believed that you had to operate a carrier or fly a carrier airplane or operate a destroyer or a submarine and take that into action. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't that kind of a war. Right. So they were just dodging, the good guys were dodging them.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. What were your initial impressions of the South Vietnamese Navy when you arrived?
Well, I was immediately very impressed with Admiral Chan, who at some point I hope you'll get a chance to meet. He's currently living with about 9 of his 10 or 11 children in Palo Alto, California, and he's enrolled in the second year of undergraduate school at the University of California. Working on a political science degree. He's a visionary and a philosopher by nature. He's a man who was perceived by his forces as having great dignity and intellect. He's more quiet and passive than his American counterparts would be, but very thoughtful. And he had had years of experience in fighting the French using the waterways and had a lot of acumen about things to do. And early on, the first couple of weeks, I just sucked him dry asking questions and absorbed a lot of his wisdom. And although the giant slingshot and other parts of the blockade of Cambodia were my concepts, he's the one who put me on to the importance of seafloat, of establishing a presence down in that rich resource area of the tip of the Delta Peninsula, mm-hmm. the Cao Mau Peninsula. So he was a strategist and an experienced tactician. And he had some very good officers. He had some who were had been fighting for years and were just trying to survive and who were slacking in the jobs, but he had some very good ones too.
Admiral Tidd suggested the other day when I talked to him that the South Vietnamese Navy was perhaps less caught up in the political machinations and the corruption that other parts of the South Vietnamese bureaucracy were. Do you think that might be a reason why someone like Commodore Chun could rise to the top, at least in that position?
Yes, I think that had a lot to do with it. And the first time he became CNO, he was CNO twice. The first time he became CNO, he was just a commander. And at one point, he detailed himself, wrote himself orders to go to the U.S. National Naval War College for the year's command staff course there that foreigners go to, and designated or got approval for another person to become CNO. So he broadened himself by being for a year at Newport in touch with officers from our Navy and 35 or 40 other navies, and then came back, and after a few years there was the outbreak of rebellion within the Navy. And Emmett, you may remember more of the details than I on this, but apparently someone overturned the CNO who was then Captain Kang, later on became Admiral Kang, and ultimately succeeded Admiral Chun. And at that point, then Captain Chun was made Commodore and returned to the CNO job. And then at the end of his tour, after I left Vietnam and after I retired from our Navy, then Admiral Kang was brought back into the Navy. He'd been stashed into the Interior Department. And he's in this country. He came, when I couldn't get Admiral Chun to leave, as Saigon was getting ready to fall, and learned that Admiral Kang had the guts to order his officers and men to get their families on board the ships and to steam out of the Saigon River and across the China Sea to Subic Bay and surrender the ships to us, not to the enemy. My wife and I invited him and his wife and three children and his sister and three children and a couple of cousins to live with us, and they spent 5 months with us. And I got to know him pretty well, and he was a man of character. He left with his life savings of $7,000, which showed you the degree of his honesty.
Based on your impression, at least, do you think that the South Vietnamese Navy, before Ak Tho, when you arrived, was the South Vietnamese Navy as much a creation of American training and equipment and doctrine as the South Vietnamese Army was?
No, I think that the South Vietnamese Navy was more a creation of the French, and that the naval advisors had just sort of elected to continue to operate within their system, but to try to improve the efficiency of those operations. Emmett, would you agree with that? And the downside of that was that the French taught the Vietnamese naval people that they should be subordinate to their army, and that they should basically just be hewers of wood and haulers of water for the army, logistic support for the army. And our advisors didn't have anyone goosing them to try to change the whole strategic concept for the use of the Navy. Now, Admiral Chun, to his credit, chafed under that and apparently couldn't get much action from the U.S. side. And one of the first things he talked to me about was the fact that he thought that if we could get more independence for the Navy, that there are a lot of things that we could begin to do.
Mm-hmm. Turning the subject a little bit, what was your first impression of General Abrams, and how did you set about turning the situation around that had existed between MACV and the Navy when you arrived?
My first impression was that he was very ungracious, and that turned out to be a lasting impression with regard to the way in which he dealt with senior officers. On the other hand, with junior people, with his soldiers and the sailors, he came across as almost an uncle, you know, or a grandfather, and they just intuitively fell in love with him. And I came to the conclusion that all Abe wanted out of an officer was to be the goddamnest best officer he could be, and that officer had to be intelligent enough and motivated enough to get the job done efficiently, and his job was just to be there to snarl if he saw something that wasn't going right. And I don't know whether it's in my book on watch or not, about my first meeting in the Weekly Intelligence Estimate Update.
I believe it is, sir.
When he made the comment about the reporter.
The Marine General and the reporter?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And that, when I laughed and looked around and nobody was laughing, and then looked at General Abrams, and he was drilling two holes right through my chest, I realized that was the lesson for the day. That was not a joke. Which sort of got me started on the right foot from there on. And the other thing he had said to me in the general briefing about the fact that the Navy doesn't do a goddamn thing, he said, I stopped having Admiral Veth participate in the Weekly Intelligence Estimate Update. The system was to have a report from each of the corps commanders, and then the component commanders, the Air Force component commander, the Army component commander, the Navy component commander, and the Marine component commander, and then from special forces and that sort of thing. And he said he had dropped having the Navy because the Navy never had a damn thing to report. And so I said, you are back on the list to report, but you're under notice. It depends on what you have to say. And that's when we went through this horrible ordeal with the chief of staff. Just couldn't get me a briefing. I found myself on Friday nights for the first two or three weeks until Emmett Tidd was in control, working myself with my flag sec and Lieutenant Commander Kerr to prepare a briefing that we just couldn't get from the staff, you know. We survived that period. And there was one really outstanding staff officer there, and that was the intelligence officer, where, as you would expect, that was a key billet for the intelligence community. And so they had a very good Navy captain there, Rex Rectanis, who later became my director of naval intelligence and still later became a deputy assistant secretary of defense for intelligence and a three-star admiral. And so by bypassing my chief of staff and getting with him, I could get the intelligence side of it and then did the operations side to get the briefings going until chief of staff Emmett Tidd took over, and then I didn't have any problem. But that's the kind of thing that Abrams did. He gave you a mission, and by God, you either did it or...
So you learned that quickly, just from observing his demeanor and his discussions at the initial meetings that you attended.
Yeah. I had a classmate, Captain Bob Stewart, who was at Sink Pack, who told me that at a staff meeting just after I left there on the way out to see General Abrams, one of the senior Air Force officers said, that guy almost seems too nice. General Abrams is going to chew him up and spit him out. And Bob Stewart said, I looked at him and said, all General Abrams is going to see of Bud Zumwalt is asshole and elbows. Working his way through.
That was true.
What was your first impression of Vietnam itself? I mean, you have, I suppose, thoughts in mind from what you've heard through the services themselves, through what you've heard from the media. But when you actually arrive on the scene yourself, what impression did you get of the atmosphere in the country, and how did that influence your thinking about how to approach your mission?
At that time, the war was going pretty well. The horror that was created by the Tet operation, although the public never understood it, it was understood by all the military that we really had wiped out almost the entire Viet Cong presence as a result of Tet, and that forced them to re-infiltrate a lot more NVA from the north to make up for those losses. The pacification program under Ambassador Bill Colby was beginning to work well. The Phoenix program was picking up the Viet Cong agents that were operating in the villages and that sort of thing. And so the threat was that coming from the States and having had those weekly briefings from Paul Nitze about what the president was thinking and what McNamara was thinking, it was clear to me, as I said in my speech today, that were you there for the speech?
Yes, sir.
That if Mr. Humphrey were elected, we had a year, and if Mr. Nixon were elected, we had 3 years to get the job done at the best, because the public was really crowding our political leaders. And so although I could see that if we could plan on 5 years, it was absolutely a cinch we didn't have that kind of time, and we better get ready for the one-year alternative and hope we got the three-year alternative. Later, as we were forced to withdraw more and more forces, the picture was a little less comfortable than that. But nevertheless, I never lost heart until Nixon left office, and I saw that neither he nor President Ford were going to be able to carry out our secret commitments.
Yes, sir. So do you feel that, based on what you've told me about receiving briefings on the situation, before you went to Vietnam, before you even knew you were going to Vietnam, how well do you think you were prepared in terms of knowledge of what was going on there, perceptions of what was happening, to immediately step in, hit the ground running, and implement the program?
I was not well prepared to know about the possibilities in the Delta, things that could be done there, because we weren't getting that picture. We were just getting the picture of the forces, the naval forces that were there, having essentially completed their job. The trawlers weren't getting in, and the major rivers weren't being used, and so I was pretty knowledgeable about the progress of the war in general. And as I say, I was very knowledgeable about the fact that time was running out over in the States. What I had to learn quickly, and Admiral Chan was very helpful in that, was some of the things that we could do to exploit the resources that we had that weren't being used.
I had told Les that you had, though, seen the utility of naval forces to do a bigger job of interdiction in waterways.
Yeah.
That's just a basic use of naval force.
That's correct. And being knowledgeable of our riverine operations in the Civil War, I knew that there was a lot of aggressive things that could be done to interdict. But you know, with regard to this, I don't think I'd ever looked at the map to see, for example, how natural that giant slingshot operation was. And it was only when I looked at it sitting at my desk in Vietnam that all of a sudden it dawned on me, hell, here's the thing that's been missed, you know.
And that was just simply looking at the map?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But that was after, of course, I'd spent a couple of weeks with Admiral Chan and flown all around the Delta and looked at things. Mm-hmm.
So, based on what you said, it seems that your perception of existing operations, like Game Warden...
I was on top of that. I knew what was going on there. But what I hadn't yet figured out was, I knew we could do better, but I hadn't figured out specifically how to use those assets.
So that was the key question in your mind when you arrived, is that...
How do I get us into the war?
Yes, sir. There are things going on already, but how do we utilize them more efficiently?
Right.
How do we be more aggressive?
Right.
Okay. I think the enduring American view of Vietnam is that this is an army war, a helicopter war. As a form of warfare, how do you think that the Navy's war in the rivers compares with helicopter-borne forces for interdiction, for counterinsurgency, for that perception of the mission?
Well, you need them both, clearly. But it's also clear that the hill-borne forces and the waterborne forces had not made it possible to pacify that delta, and that when we got the boats, the 1,000 small craft, into the narrow canals and rivers along those several hundred kilometers of the Cambodian border, we literally did bring to a slow trickle the infiltration of logistics into the Delta. And General Abrams credited that operation with reducing the casualties to his soldiers and making it possible to pacify the Delta. And I think the proof there was that not even the organized forces of the North Vietnamese tried to penetrate the Delta for two or three months after the fall of Saigon. Mm-hmm. So it took the use of those boats in an interdictory mode to use the firepower of the boats without troops on them. In some cases you had troops, but mostly without troops. It was boat gunpower that did it.
So maybe another way to put this, in your mind at least, if this is an area that has been largely inaccessible, that has been almost allowed to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese by default, is it useful, the use of these types of boats, just for, I suppose, the concept of having a presence, yes. having something on the yeah. ground or in the water, as the case yeah. may be, in that area.
And in a very real sense, what we did was give depth to the Army. The Army, there were no good places to have bases, in, for example, in the vicinity of the Parrot's Beak. It was all swampy water. The Army would launch an operation periodically out there, and then they'd have to retire to bases closer to Saigon. We established a presence on the water where it was feasible to have boats and bases, and lived very austerely there, and moved the perimeter of our forces to give more space to the Army.
Mm-hmm. You feel that the riverine strategy that was already in place when you arrived, was that a strategy that conformed with what General Westmoreland had been trying to do in terms of search and destroy?
Yes, I think General Westmoreland felt that, I talked to him when he was Chief of Staff, and before I went out, he'd been back home as Chief of Staff of the Army for just 2 or 3 months when I had orders to go out, and I asked to see him, and he described the Navy as doing its mission and described how he had wanted to marry the 9th Infantry Brigade to the armored boats, and that was a substitute for helicopter-borne troops. You could bring a lot more firepower to bear, and that had helped to break the Viet Cong down into smaller maneuver units. But he clearly didn't understand the greater uses of the Balmoral Navy.
Mm-hmm. Your view, just in order to compare the scene that you saw actually being there to what had happened before, how had you perceived General Westmoreland's strategy and the way the war had been conducted before you arrived?
I'm not sure that I had thought about it a lot in those terms. I knew that General Abrams was, at one time when he came back and gave a speech to the joint bodies of Congress, was being touted as a presidential candidate. He was that popular. But by the time the war was turned over to General Abrams and Westmoreland was brought back, the dissent within the country and the seemingly endless nature of the war had begun to make General Westmoreland much less popular, and I knew that he was sort of under the gun with the media. I was very conscious of that. I don't think I was as conscious of the difference between his performance out there and General Abrams' performance. I think General Abrams was by far the superior strategist. I don't think I saw that so clearly until I got out there.
Mm-hmm. But for something like Tet, when you were in the United States and looking back from the United States at the scene, your perception of it was, is this something that's being properly done, properly handled?
No, because the media reports were so shocking, my initial perception was that we really had blown it. Then the briefings that I got the following weekend from Paul Nitz indicated that the situation was perhaps not as bad as the media had portrayed, but I don't think it was until I got out there that I understood just how completely the Viet Cong forces had been devastated. So I didn't understand how well we had done until I got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was your view of such statistical measures of progress in the war as the body count?
I thought that was a very unfortunate choice, both because it's kind of un-American to gloat over how many dead you have, and perhaps more importantly, it's not a very good measure of pacification, and most importantly of all, regrettably, there were cases where Army commanders weren't too careful about who they killed in order to get the body count up.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this, how much of this was a follow-on from the system that had been put into place in the Pentagon by McNamara?
It was clearly the result of the pressure from McNamara to have some kind of a statistical measure. Mm-hmm. he would have been much better off to have relied on weekly briefings being prepared by the court's people, by Bill Kobe, who constantly out talking to the village chiefs and getting a kind of a qualitative feeling for pluses and minuses, where we were doing well, where we were doing less well, and so on. Mr. McNamara never really understood that in the art of war, statistics just can't tell you the whole story. They can tell you part of it, but not the whole part.
So you from things that you had seen in the Pentagon and things that you've been doing in the Pentagon in terms of planning, do you think that that method was useful for a peacetime kind of planning more appropriately than, say, for trying to judge the progress in Vietnam?
Yeah, I do think it would have been more appropriate to have statistical analysis in war, in peacetime, because that's the only thing you can't measure. You can't measure, you know, the outcomes of campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was well understood in the Navy that people in our OPO-6, the strategic end of the Navy business, I think had a very good handle on just how bad the McNamara figures of merit were. Emmett would be a better expert on that.
I agree that they were bad, that you couldn't, but the problem was you couldn't prove they were right.
Right. I hope you'll speak up whenever you have a problem with anything I'm saying, too, Emmett. So.
Yes, sir. I would advise of what the Admiral meant to say was.
The role you're accustomed to.
I doubt if I'll say much.
Did McNamara pay any attention to pacification statistics or just the other kinds of negative types of statistics that are more famous from the war?
I think he tried to get pacification statistics. I don't know how much, I know he tried to get them. I don't know how much he relied on the information he got. I believe he was pretty mesmerized by body count.
Mm-hmm. Or truck count from the thunder, things like that.
Right.
Discuss your memories of the genesis in your mind and in your staff of the Sea Lord's concept.
Well, the first thing in my recollection was that we had a Lieutenant J.G. by the name of Bernique, who violated the rules of the road, the rules of engagement, and was reported to have driven at high speed across the Ben Tay Canal, which was the canal that connected the Gulf of Thailand to the Mekong River, right along the Cambodian border. It marked the Cambodian border. And he had shot up a bunch of Viet Cong tax collectors. And I got a message recommending him for a court-martial. We called him to Saigon. Were you there at that time?
No, it happened just before that.
We called him to Saigon, and I asked to see him. And when I got through talking to him, I decided first that he brought very valuable information, as had Captain Horatio Nelson when he decided to cross the T in violation of orders, and that what he had done said to me that we could do some operations there. So I authorized him to get a medal instead of a court-martial, and it became known as Bernique's Creek.
The canal?
The canal. But because nothing had been done there, I thought it was probably better to test it first. And so I asked Commodore Bob Salzer, who was a very outstanding naval officer and had been running the Mobile Riverine Flotilla, the armored boats, working with the 9th Infantry Division, to come to Saigon, and asked him what he thought about putting an operation on the canal, the name of which I've forgotten, that was about halfway up toward the Cambodian border. We ended up calling that operation Search Turn. And Bob said, well, you know, it's a breathtaking concept, but I think it would work. And he had some practical suggestions about the fact that you'd need to establish some austere operating bases on that canal to make it work. So I put him in charge of an operation to test it, and it was successful. We picked up some Viet Cong crossings and knocked off some logistics. And that convinced me then that we could go up to the Ben Tay Canal, which we did next. And it was then after that that I was sitting in my office one day looking at the map and realized that there, sitting on both sides of the Parrot's Beak, were the Vam Co Tay and Vam Co Dong rivers, which were still narrow, but not as narrow as the Ben Tay Canal. And by golly, that was a much more major area of penetration, because the Viet Cong properly saw it as close enough to Saigon that they could make a fast run across the Parrot's Beak and get in close to Saigon with their logistics. So that was a natural place to extend the operation, and then if we did that, we then could put an operation connecting the two parts of it across the Plain of Reeds, which we did, called Barrier Reef, and tie the whole thing together. That Barrier Reef part of it was really sort of an afterthought after we had gotten the giant slingshot part of it started. That became so successful that it was clear that the Viet Cong would next try to come across the Plain of Reeds, so that was the place to close the final link.
Backing up a moment to Michael Bernique, when he came in front of your desk, was he of the mind that this was the end for him, or did he expect that you might give him an opportunity to...
My impression of him was, and I don't know whether he stayed in the Navy, I don't think he did.
I don't believe so.
My impression of him was that he was one of these rough-hewn, kind of devil-may-care types of people that you really love to have in war, who didn't give too much of a damn about authority. And he was bored with what he was doing, and so decided, by golly, I'm just going to find out whether he can get into that so-called hornet's nest of communists and get away with it. And he was sort of the General Patton type at a much more junior level.
Okay. Was Search Turn then a forerunner to the Sea Lords itself?
Yeah. The Search Turn was the name of that first operation, and Giant Slingshot was the name of the Parrot's Beak operation, but the two rivers on both sides. And then when we saw how successful that was, and the thought of connecting the two, the Barrier Reef operation across the Plain of Reeds, I was looking for some way to really teach the other services the significance of this, and to give our Navy some way, our Navy guys some way of having something to really cling to and be motivated by. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of, I played around with Southeast Asia, Lake Ocean, River Delta strategy, playing with the sequence of words until we could get it to come out with something that made sense, and Sea Lords then struck a bell, and the next thought was, well, then good, we can make the deputy first Sea Lords, and cornball it up that way. And when General Abrams first heard about it, I think he was kind of he tended to be a conventional person with regard to protocol, although if you look at his record in World War II, he was unconventional as hell as a tank commander, and he was Patton's Patton. But he finally decided to leave it alone and got pretty proud of it after we turned in some success.
So when he first heard the name and the idea, he wondered what the Navy was up to?
And have you cleared this with the Corps commanders? Yes, sir.
So, in effect, then, these initial early operations, you were testing the water, and then when you see that there's something useful in this, and it does achieve results, then you're going to unify it as a strategy.
To try to block off the whole Cambodian.
And develop it from there as you see how it works. Okay.
In this context, I pointed out some of your willingness to take a risk that was later reflected in your CNO term. Right. And another example of our ability, how kind you were to me as the chief of staff, when I came in and told you that everything was priority one, we had to change that priority. I would select priorities, clear them with you if they're wrong. Slingshot was an example of how I would be devil's advocate when the staff was presenting the concept to you, how we're going to execute your concept, and how later you stopped me as they were going out of the room to tell me you appreciated that, you understood what I was doing, and that's exactly what you needed also.
Sure, that was.
But it reflected your willingness to listen and to put up with other people.
And also that the idea of writing out memos called ZWIs, Zamoas Wild Ideas, was basically the same thing. In war, it's so dangerous to get a bright idea and implement it that you want people to kind of do what the chief of staff was doing, to be agnostic about it. And a lot of bad ideas got shot down that way, and a lot of good ideas got improved. And occasionally one got through all the way without being changed. But you wanted people to kind of look at it suspiciously, because you could make if you made a mistake, you were going to get people killed. Mm-hmm. So yes, take the risks, but first be damn sure that everybody had had their shot at it.
Given the French experience and later U.S. experience, and you sit there and look at the map and see the Parrot's Beak jutting out into towards Saigon with key waterways there, why do you think that hasn't anyone thought of this before?
Well, I think that the French, as I said, taught the Vietnamese that the Navy was the tool of the Army. Mm-hmm. I think the French thought that was the case for themselves, not just for the Vietnamese. And therefore, I think the French Army just didn't give the French Navy a chance to use its own initiatives and kept them in the brown water side of it, just as a logistic support force.
So it's just a differing perception of the utility of naval force.
Yeah, and probably less willingness on the part of the French commander-in-chief, who was an Army officer, to let the Navy have some independence. General Abrams, over time, came to be willing to let me really have a lot more freedom than in the beginning, where every time I went to him, it was, did you talk to the Corps commander about this? Did the Corps commander go along with this? Later on, he got to where he would say, go down and sell it to the Corps commander, you know. Because he was the kind of a guy who was willing to grow in an area that he had not dealt with, we were able to do things that the French Navy commander